While we hesitated, among the black bushes behind us and dim against their blackness, I saw three crouching figures. There was scrub and long grass all about us, and I did not feel safe from their insidious approach. The forest, I calculated, was rather less than a mile across. If we could get through it to the bare hillside, there, as it seemed to me, was an altogether safer resting place. I thought that with my matches and my camphor, I could contrive to keep my path illuminated through the woods. Yet it was evident that if I was to flourish matches with my hands, I should have to abandon my firewood. So, rather reluctantly, I put it down. And then it came into my head that I would amaze our friends behind by lighting it. I was to discover the atrocious folly of this proceeding, but it came to my mind as an ingenious move for covering our retreat.
HPPodcraft.com.
If I had a nickel for every time I had a plan that ended in folly, I would have a lot of flipping nickels.
That's retirement money.
It is.
I don't think I need to ask, but what science fiction novel did we just hear from?
That opening reading is from H.G. Wells' The Time Machine.
Yes.
And this is our fourth and final episode dedicated to the covering of it on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are at HPPodcraft.com. My name is Chad Pfeiffer.
And I am Chris Lackey. And that reader is the megalithic... Does that work?
It works as applied to Greg.
Greg Johnson. And you can hear him and I rock out some Lovecraftian comedy drama in Quiet and Bold at quietandbold.com. If you want to see Greg's beautiful face, you can hit him up on his awesome YouTube page. Or if you live in the UK, you can catch him on the BBC, on BBC Two in July, the MASH Report.
MASH Report. Excellent. Well, Greg, of course, is also getting a lot of attention for his greeting card business.
Oh, yeah.
Or what he calls his unauthorized greeting cards. They're these little notes and trinkets that he sends to different people who didn't ask for them. Just various women he's seen around town and some celebrities, a few bodybuilders. And some of these notes are encouraging.
What?
They're encouraging notes or sweet little poems. Most of them are vaguely threatening, though. And I mean, he says it's a business. I don't really understand how it's a business. But like I say, he's getting a lot of attention for it, mostly from the police. But he seems pleased with it. It just goes to show Greg's just good at everything he does. Or at least he pursues it with a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm. You know what I'm saying?
There you go.
Where are we in this story?
The story so far, our time traveler, Herb, is stuck in the future with the weak and stupid Eloy, while the cannibalistic underground dwellers, known as the Morlocks, have his time machine.
He's decided that he needs to arm himself against the Morlocks. They've already been a little handsy, a little feely, a little touchy with him. He and Weena have walked out to this giant palace museum where he kind of learned some stuff, but basically all he really got out of is he created a mace to hit them with.
He got some fire.
He got some fire as well. Yeah. So now they're going to return to where he thinks the Morlocks are keeping his time machine, but they have to cross through those deep, dark woods to get there.
At the top of the episode, we heard Herb have a genius plan to get through the night because the Morlocks don't do good with light. Mm-hmm. So he's out in the woods with a fire ready to go, but not yet lit.
Right.
And I'm not sure why he didn't light it. I guess he just wanted to try and catch him.
Well, no, he wanted to cross through the woods because he thinks he'll have a better shot at defending himself overnight on the bare hillside beyond.
Right.
But they're tired, and just as they're hitting the edge of the woods, it's getting dark fast, and the Morlocks are starting to come out after him. So the twigs he's got in his arms and the wood he's collected so far, he thinks, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to light this on fire here, and that'll be cover for us while we escape into the woods. So he drops it so that he can light the match. I love what he says. He goes, it came into my head that I would amaze our friends behind by lighting it. When I hear amaze your friends, you know, I just think of those ads from the back of comic books.
Oh, yeah.
That was the piece of copy they would always use. You know, learn to be a ventriloquist, amaze your friends. Yeah. Get your hypno coin, amaze your friends. And sometimes it was really misplaced use of it, like, you know, genuine wound, make it look like your throat is cut. Amaze your friends. You know, it's like, what? Should be more like develop trust issues with your friends. But he decides that he's going to freak out the Morlocks by starting this fire now so they can escape. And in this world, which is temperate and provides everything, you know, fire's been lost to these people.
Yeah.
They don't know, the Morlocks don't know what it is.
I'm a little suspect of his plan. I think he just should have made a fire, keep it going the whole night, and then they would have stayed away from it.
Yeah, I don't know why on this side of it he didn't start a fire, get some rest,
yeah,
and then go through the woods when he's not insane. But he's scared and desperate, and he just wants to get through it.
Like you said, fire is unknown to the Eloi, and when Weena, Herb's friend, who is an Eloi, sees it. She loves it, and she wants to play with it and run around with it. I mean, I guess pretty much like everybody else does, but she's more on the side of she will hurt herself with it,
yeah,
as opposed to let's burn this mother down, which is what most people are on the side of fire. You know, you just want to burn
the fire is intriguing when you first encounter it and are able to make it yourself, but she just wants to jump right into it. She doesn't understand the nature of it at all. They did that scene in the movie, in the 60s movie as well.
Oh, yeah?
Where she saw the fire and she starts moving toward it and he's got to restrain her.
As it's getting dark, Weena is getting more and more scared. So at this point, he's carrying her and he's got his iron cudgel in one hand and then he's got Weena in the other. He has no free hands to light the matches. He's got to either put down his weapon or his lady.
And as he's plunging into the woods, he sees that the fire he lit is starting to spread across the grass on the hillside, and he actually kind of laughs about it. Clearly, he's not aware of the dangers of forest fires.
No.
this is, I think, why he said the plan didn't go as expected. There's no Smokey the Bear in either his time in the 1890s or in the future to warn him about this thing.
That's true.
But they leave the fire behind, and they plunge into the blackness of the woods.
Then he hears footsteps all around the trees and Morlocks talking to each other, which actually sounds a lot like the Dutch language. The Morlocks are
chilling,
touching him as he puts Weena down to light a match. He strikes it and they run off. He sees Weena lying on the ground, clutching at his leg in total fear. He lights the Kempner. It blazes bright. He again looks down at Weena and she seems to have fainted. After it burns out, Herb gets a bit turned around and he doesn't know where the hell he is or where his fire is set up, and it's pitch black.
Yeah, they're far enough away from the fire that he'd set that he can't see it anymore. He's only able to light the camphor for short amounts of time to keep the Morlocks off. And he'd been going in one direction away from the Green Palace. That's why he knew he's heading the right place. But now that he's had a tussle with them, he's all turned around. He's probably turned 3 or 4 or 5 times. So which direction he should be going, he doesn't know.
He lights some more Kempner and then sees a Morlock ready to get Weena. So Herb flipping punches him in the face, like breaking bones kind of iron fist deal. You know what I mean? And I believe he had the glow when he did it. Probably more like Shownuff and less like Bruce Leroy. But remember, it's he who's telling the story, so believe what you will.
Well, I don't think anybody listening to this knows that reference that you just made.
I think a lot of people know that reference.
Well, it's from The Last Dragon, which is a fantastic film. I saw it at the theater every weekend when it was out in 1985. My sister and I liked that movie so much. It starts at the beginning with the old TriStar logo, which was like a Pegasus.
Yep.
We liked it so much that my sister asked for and received a Pegasus stuffed animal for Christmas. So we were like getting merchandising from just the logo. That's how much we liked The Last Dragon. In the story where we are now, he's fended off the Morlock attack, but Ween has fainted.
Right. He notices that the leaves on the ground are pretty much dry. There hasn't been any rain since he's been here for the whole week.
Right.
So he jumps up and he grabs some branches and he gets a real fire going with his campner.
Well, now he can save the rest of the camphor because he's got the leaves burning. So it's a good way for him to, because up till then he's been just blowing it.
He's super tired as he hasn't really slept in a few days and the fire's going now and he takes a rest just for a second, but then it's not really a second and he nods off.
Yeah, it really captures that feeling of falling asleep when you don't want to. He says, I seemed just to nod and open my eyes, but all was dark and the Morlocks had their hands upon
me.
So clearly a lot of time had passed. It's pretty scary.
Yeah, the fire goes out and they are on him, taking his matches. I guess they're also small because he says that they dogpile on him and start pulling his hair and biting him. And he thinks he's done for, but he feels his iron club and it's clobbering time and he's able to start taking him out. It says, it gave me strength. I struggled up, shaking the human rats from me and holding the bar short. I thrust where I judged their faces might be. I could feel the succulent giving of flesh and bone under my blows. And for a moment, I was free. The succulent giving of flesh and bone. Ugh.
He got to fulfill his dream of rocking some Morlocks.
He did, man.
Or so.
Or so. He's kicking ass, but he knows he's not going to last against so many of them. And he gets his back up against a tree and he's just swinging. But they don't actually attack him. And he thinks maybe it's because they're afraid of him. But then he realizes that he can actually start to see a bit. And there are three Morlocks down on the ground and the rest are running off into the woods. And he notices that when he sees them, they actually have kind of more of a reddish hue. And he's like, that's weird. Why are they? Oh, and then he looks behind him and he sees that he has started a forest fire.
He says it was my first fire coming after me. You know, it was an accident, but And he talks about it like it was a bad end of the plan, but clearly this is saving him.
Yeah.
Burning everything down isn't a terrible strategy when people are afraid of light.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in this light, he sees that Weena is missing. She is nowhere to be seen now.
Yeah. The fire's getting closer fast, so Herb runs after the Morlocks. One of them, seemingly blind from the light of the fire, runs past him and into the fire. He's just going nuts on these Morlocks. He says, at first, I did not realize their blindness and struck furiously at them with my bar in a frenzy of fear as they approached me, killing one and crippling several more.
Right.
Whoa.
Well, they're running at him and he thinks they're coming for me, but they're not. No. They're just blind, scrambling around
and freaking out
aimlessly.
And then once he realizes that, he stops attacking them. Or so he tells us, because I think Herb probably got some bloodlust there and was just
absolutely
going crazy on him. The Morlocks are freaking out and blinded by the firelight, so much so that Herb can just walk among them, which he does, looking for Weena, but she's gone.
Maybe she continued shrinking until she just disappeared. He should check among the blades of grass.
He just watches the madness, you know, punching any Morlock that gets too close to him, you know.
Yeah.
He thought the whole thing was a nightmare at first. He wasn't sure if what he was seeing was real. Like, he goes, maybe I'm asleep and dreaming this because this is so surreal and crazy.
Yeah.
But no, just horrible. He says, thrice I saw Morlocks put their heads down in a kind of agony and rush into the flames.
Do you think they're doing that because they want to end the agony they're in? Or do they think they can somehow stop the fire?
I think it's just craziness. I think that they have never had to deal with anything like this before and they just don't know what to do.
I think they're just confused and they think if I run at this thing, maybe it'll stop.
Could be. Or they're just desperate, you know?
The time traveler's having a pretty Lovecraftian breakdown. He says, I bit myself and screamed in a passionate desire to awake. I beat the ground with my hands and got up and sat down again and wandered here and there and again sat down. Then I would fall to rubbing my eyes and calling upon God to let me awake.
Wow.
Watching these creatures freak out like this is horrible. Yeah. This is horrible to watch, and it's a bad scene.
Finally, the morning comes, and he is looking for Weena more, but she's not around. He doesn't find her alive or dead. He kind of thinks, you know, I should just go kill all these blinded and injured Morlocks, but then he sort of has mercy on them. And he's all messed up. He's exhausted. He's hurt. He's lonely. He thinks about his Victorian chums, and he misses his old life.
Well, he says, I began to think of this house of mine, of this fireside, of some of you, and with such thoughts came a longing that was pain.
Some of you.
So, yeah, the people in the room are probably like, some of us? Who weren't you thinking of? I mean, and he didn't have to say it that way. There's no way they can check up on what he was thinking about. No. So he should have just said, I began to think of you chaps, you know, but he doesn't. And I think that must have been a dig on Philby or something. Yeah. You know, there must have been a specific reason.
Of course.
Yeah. As the dawn comes, he can make out the Palace of Green Porcelain in the distance, that museum, which allows him to reorient himself and get moving again. Mm-hmm. But he is exhausted and beat, has had a miserable night of watching Morlocks burn themselves alive. And he knows that Ween has been killed or dragged off for food, which is all pretty upsetting because he was kind of her protector, you know, and he let her get him captured.
He's about to just kind of give up when he reaches into his pocket and he finds some loose matches. And he's like, yeah, I ain't finished.
Yeah, when the Morlocks pickpocketed him, they got the box, but some of the matches spilled out. So he may need them for his final attack, because remember, he's got to try and break through the pedestal of the Sphinx statue, possibly carve up some more Morlocks so he can get to his time machine.
Yeah.
He keeps walking from this point to get a new sense of purpose with his matches, and about 8 or 9 in the morning, he arrives back where he first landed in the time machine.
Yeah.
He thinks about the conclusions he had made when landing and how different things are now.
He thinks about the Eloi and how they're just happy cattle. And he's bummed about humanity's intellectual suicide, as he calls it, how people just gave it up for comfort. He says, it is a law of nature we overlook, that intellectual versatility is the compensation for change, danger, and trouble. An animal perfectly in harmony with its environment is a perfect mechanism. Nature never appeals to intelligence until habit and instinct are useless. There is no intelligence where there is no change and no need of change. Only those animals partake of intelligence that have to meet a huge variety of needs and dangers. These Eloi don't have any needs and don't have any dangers, so they just don't advance. They don't they don't change and their intellect fades away. But the Morlocks, on the other hand, they seem to have some needs. Their machinery they have to maintain, which one could guess they're maintaining their environment is what all the machinery is for.
Yeah, we never find out exactly what it is, but having to maintain machinery is going to cause them to have to think a little bit, which makes them just a little sharper than the Eloi. And because of that, when food ran out for them, they were able to come up with a system of eating Eloi that's been working out quite well. So that was the invention that came about as a result of adversity.
Yeah.
And it is true that not just necessity, but adversity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. You mentioned last episode how much main character was getting done under threat of Morlock attack.
Yeah.
And I'd say that's not just true of science and technology, but also of art. If life isn't hard, these things can stagnate.
Yeah.
We all live now in the harder world.
Yeah.
The Eloi, despite the occasional cannibalism, have it pretty good. Which society would you rather live in?
Well, ours, for sure. I don't want to be eaten by Morlocks.
Do all of the Eloi get eaten by Morlocks? Or is it just a kind of a sacrifice here and there?
Well, we don't know how many Eloi there are, but if you look at cattle and how many cows are consumed by people over a period of time, that's a lot of people, you know, that got to be fed. So they said there are no old Eloi, so you don't have a very long life.
Well, maybe that's not true. I mean, maybe I thought that was more because they've perfected disease and aging.
It could be. It could be that.
It's genetic improvements that are keeping people from getting older.
Well, you know, it's the whole, they don't seem too aware of their lives and who they are. They just sort of exist almost as animals.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like the life unexamined is not really a life worth living.
But that sounds like what you would say to somebody who's got a crappy life. These people don't experience any real suffering. They don't have to work. They don't have to provide for anybody.
Yeah.
They have no sexual rivalries, no war, no sickness. And death comes for them, but for the most part, they just get to chill out and be happy all the time. Maybe they don't appreciate it because things never get bad, but I don't know.
Perhaps it's my own intellectual failing to be able to realize how good and maybe even better the Eloi life would be, but I feel like my existence is better. That's better in quotes, because how am I measuring that? Like, what does that mean exactly when you say better? But I just think that it's a more interesting life, but then again, their life is just interesting enough for them because they're totally stupid. So,
well, that's the thing. I vacillate between, I go, gosh, these Eloi are idiots. I couldn't stand to be around them. And then on the other hand, I go, yeah, but it sounds really nice. I mean, they just get up and they go out in the woods and they dance around for a bit, then they lay down and then, you know, they eat the fruit that they didn't even have to go cook or buy or anything. And I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's it like to be, you know, any animal that is high up on the food chain that doesn't really have to worry about any of those things? I don't know.
I'm just saying, probably depending on the day, I either envy or despise the Eloi. It's a couple of perspectives to have on it. Well, I also like how in this paragraph here, when he's speculating on how the Morlocks became intelligent enough to be cannibals, he says he's very clear that he may still be wrong about everything.
Oh, sure.
He says, so I say I saw it in my last view of the world of 800 and 2701. It may be as wrong an explanation as mortal wit could invent. It is how the thing shaped itself to me, and as that I give it to you. So, you know, for all he knows, the rest of the world is nothing like this.
Yeah.
I mean, he may be on the set of some advanced video game or something.
Sure.
Maybe, you know, these could all be like clones that were created so that somebody could play out some scenario, and there's hyper-intelligent people just on the other side of the, you know, the mountains.
Sure. Or just on another continent. There could be, like, in Africa, there could be this huge advanced civilization, Star Trek-like, in its utopian.
Wakanda could still be out there.
If any nation would live to the year 800,000, it would be Wakanda.
Absolutely.
As he thinks about all this, he's laying in the grass and he falls asleep. He wakes up just before sunset, picks up his club, and he's going on down to the Sphinx because he's ready to kick some ass. But when he gets down there, the doors are open. What? Huh. And he's like, okay. All right, I'm going to go in there and get my time machine. But then he thinks,
Could be a surrender by the Morlocks. But then he thinks, no, they're smart enough because they do go grab people to eat them.
Yeah.
So they probably know this basic thing. They've set a trap here, haven't they? They've put my time machine there so that I'll come in and then they can grab me.
Mm-hmm.
But he tries not to laugh at them because, of course, what they don't know is that once he's in the machine, he's ghosting.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if he's in that thing or not. By the way, there was a really interesting part in the we were saying, why did he go so far into the future in one of our earlier episodes?
Yeah.
In the film, they did an interesting thing to explain it where I think it was a mountain. He was in rock.
Oh.
He was traveling and then suddenly like a mountain grew up around him. And if he stopped, he would have been trapped within. Yeah. So he just had to keep going till that mountain was gone. Otherwise, he couldn't stop. So that was what they did to explain him going so far into the future, which I thought was incredibly
clever. That's really clever. Yeah. He sees the time machine is in there. And he goes in. Now, I thought he was going to be smarter than this. It was his Victorian ego just going, hey, man, I'm a badass. I'm going to come in there.
It kind of is. Yeah. I mean, he thinks they're fools for setting this trap that he's so clearly going to be able to get out of.
So he goes over, checks out his machine. It's been cleaned and oiled. But just then the doors behind him are closed. It's a trap. He's like, oh, well, oh, you think you got me? Guess what? I got a match. I got matches. But oh, wait, this match that I have is one of those matches that needs to be struck on the box. I can't just do it on my jeans or on my finger or whatever it is. Uh-oh.
You may imagine how all my calm vanished. The little brutes were close upon me, one touched me. I made a sweeping blow in the dark at them with the levers and began to scramble into the saddle of the machine. Then came one hand upon me and then another. Then I had simply to fight against their persistent fingers for my levers and at the same time feel for the studs over which these fitted. One, indeed, they almost got away from me. As it slipped from my hand, I had to butt in the dark with my head. I could hear the Morlock's skull ring to recover it. It was a nearer thing than the fight in the forest, I think, this last scramble. But at last, the lever was fitted and pulled over. The clinging hand slipped from me. The darkness presently fell from my eyes. I found myself in the same grey light and tumult I have already described.
A very harrowing escape.
Yeah.
Action-packed.
That is close, man. He almost lost his flipping lever.
Yeah, it got taken from him and then he headbutted.
Headbutt.
I like it.
So Herb zooms into the future and he says, "The alterations of night and day grew slower and slower, and so did the passage of the sun across the sky. The earth had stopped rotating. The sun became larger and red. The moon was gone. The tides were gone. And he found himself on a desolate beach."
The air isn't stirring. The sea just moves, it says, with a slightly oily swell, like a gentle breathing. Kind of disgusting.
Yeah.
But proves to him that he thinks there's still life in the seas. The rocks are all red on the beach. There are these green plants and kind of the plants that would grow in shade, even though the sun is enormous. And things do cross over into the weird here. I really remember when I first read this, I had an inkling about the Eloi Morlock stuff, but I had no idea what strange creatures were going to show up in the end of this book.
Mm.
Far away, up the desolate slope, I heard a harsh scream and saw a thing like a huge white butterfly go slanting and fluttering up into the sky and, circling, disappear over some low hillocks beyond. The sound of its voice was so dismal that I shivered and seated myself more firmly upon the machine. Looking round me again, I saw that quite near, what I had taken to be a reddish mass of rock was moving slowly towards me. Then I saw the thing was really a monstrous crab-like creature. Can you imagine a crab as large as yonder table, with its many legs moving slowly and uncertainly, its big claws swaying, its long antennae like carter's whips waving and feeling, and its stalked eyes gleaming at you on either side of its metallic front? Its back was corrugated and ornamented with ungainly bosses, and a greenish incrustation blotched it here and there. I could see the many palps of its complicated mouth flickering and feeling as it moved. As I stared at this sinister apparition crawling towards me, I felt a tickling on my cheek as though a fly had lighted there. I tried to brush it away with my hand, but in a moment it returned, and almost immediately came another by my ear. I struck at this and caught something thread-like. It was drawn swiftly out of my hand. With a frightful qualm, I turned, and I saw that I had grasped the antenna of another monster crab that stood just behind me. Its evil eyes were wriggling on their stalks, its mouth was all alive with appetite, and its vast, ungainly claws, smeared with an algal slime, were descending upon me.
Yeah. Now that's some Lovecraftian stuff right there.
Yes.
Giant crab-like creature things with algae on their slime mouths and oh.
Oh man.
So he sees that, he flips the machine a month into the future.
That doesn't help.
That does no, they're still there, these things. Dozens of them are flopping around on the beach. He says, "I cannot convey the sense of abominable desolation that hung over the world. The red eastern sky, the northward blackness, the salt dead sea, the stony beach crawling with these foul, slow-stirring monsters, the uniform poisonous-looking green of the lichenous plants, the thin air that hurts one's lungs, all contributed to the appalling effect." So yeah, I was wondering, if the sun is getting bigger, how is he able to survive in this environment?
I don't know.
He goes further into the future. As he does this, he kind of really knows the fate of Earth.
Yeah.
But he stops again, and the crab things are gone. There's only lichen that's alive.
That air, it reminds him of his past when he's gone mountaineering. So, I mean, he's barely able to breathe, yeah. Like being at a high altitude. Probably he wouldn't be able to breathe it.
Yeah.
But for the sake of us finding out what happens here,
right.
He can. There's a scary moment, too, because it looks like it's only lichen alive.
Yes.
In this future. And then it says, "A shallow sandbank had appeared in the sea and the water had receded from the beach. I fancied I saw some black object flopping about upon this bank, but it became motionless as I looked at it, and I judged that my eye had been deceived, and that the black object was merely a rock. I don't know.
Yeah. Further into the future, the earth is cold and dark and lifeless. But is it?
A horror of this great darkness came on me. The cold that smote to my marrow and the pain I felt in breathing overcame me. I shivered and a deadly nausea seized me. Then, like a red-hot bow in the sky, appeared the edge of the sun. I got off the machine to recover myself. I felt giddy and incapable of facing the return journey. As I stood, sick and confused, I saw again the moving thing upon the shoal. There was no mistake now that it was a moving thing, against the red water of the sea. It was a round thing, the size of a football, perhaps, or it may be bigger, and tentacles trailed down from it. It seemed black against the weltering blood-red water, and it was hopping fitfully about. Then I felt I was fainting, but a terrible dread of lying helpless in that remote and awful twilight sustained me while I clambered upon the saddle.
Now that is Lovecraftian.
Yeah, I don't like that one bit.
Then he comes back to his own time. He notices that his machine is moved.
Right.
He was in a different place since it was moved in the future by the Morlocks.
But it was moved the exact distance from where he landed in the future to the White Sphinx, which is, that's also really crazy because he will now look at the corner of his workshop and always know in the future that's going to be this weird Morlock statue, yeah, that corner over there, you know, where I have my Dukes of Hazzard calendar. That's going to be the White Sphinx someday.
He tells the guys that this is my story. I'm sure you're not going to believe it, but that's it. The editor, you know, he stood up with the sign. He goes, "What a pity you're not a writer of stories." And he's like, "So you don't believe it, huh?" And he's like, "Nope."
Yeah, none of them do. The only evidence he has of his travel to the future are these flowers.
Yes. And the medical man, he wants to take those flowers with him. And Herb says, "No, they're all I got of the future. And you're not going to run off with them, guy who doesn't believe me. So screw you." He gets all bummed out about his trip. And he even wonders if it was real.
Oh, it was so surreal. I mean, it kind of feels like, do you remember that feeling you would have? You'd get summer vacation from school. You'd leave school and you'd go off and you'd have 3 months of a whole different life.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd come back to school and it felt like you never left.
Yeah.
Like those 3 months were just a dream.
Yeah.
And I feel like that must be exactly how he feels.
Sure.
I had this whole thing going on, but now everything seems so normal.
And that was so strange compared
to
what goes on now that maybe it wasn't a real thing. So Herb apologizes for being all weird, but he insists his story was true. It's late. Everybody goes home. The narrator goes to see him the next day. He sees the time traveler leaving the house for the lab, and he's got this, you know, satchel with him and a camera, like he's getting ready.
He's remembering to bring a camera this time.
Yeah, he's going on a trip. So Herb tells him, you know, "I'm busy. I really can't hang out with you today." And the narrator asks him again if his story was true. And Herb's like, "Yeah, it was true." And Herb says, "You know what? If you want to wait a half an hour, I'll bring you back some proof." And he says, "I've got some magazines.
Can I have a little lunch? Just chill out here.
And I'll be back." And then the narrator agrees to wait. But while he's waiting, the narrator remembers that he had an appointment that he had to do. And he's like, "Oh, shoot." So he runs to go tell Herb that he can't wait around for him. And he goes into the lab. And right as he opens the door, there's a whoosh and a crash. He sees that the machine is gone. The narrator sort of ends the story by saying, "You know, I'm still waiting. And it's been 3 years since he left. And he's probably not going to return. And I've read these magazines like 20 times each. And I'm tired of having sandwiches. So I really, really hope he comes."
3 years of eating sandwiches and reading magazines. And time traveler still hasn't returned. And then we get this epilogue.
One cannot choose but wonder, will he ever return? It may be that he swept back into the past and fell among the blood-drinking, hairy savages of the Age of Unpolished Stone, into the abysses of the Cretaceous Sea, or among the grotesque saurians, the huge reptilian brutes of the Jurassic times. He may even now, if I may use the phrase, be wandering on some plesiosaurus-haunted, oolitic coral reef, or beside the lonely saline lakes of the Triassic Age. Or did he go forward into one of the nearer ages, in which men are still men, but with the riddles of our own time answered and its wearisome problems solved, into the manhood of the race? For I, for my own part, cannot think that these latter days of weak experiment, fragmentary theory, and mutual discord are indeed man's culminating time. I say, for my own part, he, I know, for the question had been discussed among us long before the time machine was made, thought but cheerlessly of the advancement of mankind, and saw, in the growing pile of civilization, only a foolish heaping that must inevitably fall back upon and destroy its makers in the end. If that is so, it remains for us to live as though it were not so. But to me, the future is still black and blank, is a vast ignorance lit at a few casual places by the memory of his story. And I have by me, for my comfort, two strange white flowers, shriveled now and brown and flat and brittle, to witness that even when mind and strength had gone, gratitude and a mutual tenderness still lived on in the heart of man.
That's the end of the book. And I guess that last statement was the whole point of the character of Weena, to show that even among these futuristically spoiled idiots, that little bit of mutual tenderness is still in there.
Yeah.
She was grateful for him having saved her life.
Right.
Gave him those flowers.
I forgot that Weena is just gone. Like, I thought for some reason, I guess maybe I was getting it confused with the film, but that somehow she was rescued or he found her or something.
Yeah.
But no, she's freaking toast.
You know, and it's so great that he actually never sees what happened to her.
Yeah.
It's a little more realistic than I found her, you know, strapped to a tree with her throat cut or something. It's like, nope, she's just gone and I'll never know what happened.
And you'll never know. Yeah. There's a lot of that stuff that feels very realistic, especially, you know, where he just says, well, I think this is what the Morlocks are all about, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea, but this is what I'm putting together from what I've seen. So, that, you know, it's pretty cool.
Well, it's a great book. It's been such a blast reading it all month. Oh, I forgot how much I enjoy it. I didn't get to discuss any of Wells' free love philosophy. I thought that might come up. But there's probably going to be other opportunity to do that. You know, he's got some other books that I would love to cover, specifically The Island of Dr. Moreau, which I loved when I was young. That would be an awesome one to look at.
I've never read that story, so I was a fan of that. I would check it out for sure.
Oh, great. Well, yeah, maybe let's get it on the schedule. Next up, we are going to do some Robert E. Howard for July.
Yeah.
You know, it's summertime. I don't want to think too much. Let's just get some guys out there killing monsters and fighting them. And,
yeah.
They're all going to be mythos-related stories, too. I'd like to take a hard left and get back into the Lovecraftiana.
Yeah.
Doing that stuff for most of the rest of the year. But next up, we're going to read a story called The Fire of Assurbanipal. I think that's how it's pronounced. We'll link out to it in the show notes. But it's by Robert E. Howard. It's got all kinds of good mythos monsters in it. So fun excitement from the hands of Robert E. Howard.
Yes.
We've got a week off next week, so there will be no new show.
Nope.
The last week of June. But you'll remember that we have a full reading of The Yellow Wallpaper Heather Klinke. That's already been released a while ago to our backers for that, our Kickstarter backers. Mm-hmm. It was the last reward from our Kickstarter a couple years ago. They've had long enough with it just in their own hands, so we're going to release it to the general public on our week off.
That's right.
Good summer story of madness and misogyny. What everybody loves in a good summer read.
Yeah. When I think of the beach, pina coladas, and misogynistic abuse.
Yep.
I want to thank Greg Johnson for doing an awesome reading all month and the end of last month as well.
Yeah.
Greg, you are a talent which everybody can experience again at quietandbold.com, but also catch him on the MASH Report. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
And I've had a great time reading this book with you. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.